I found some letters that kids had written, and the third one leads me into my sermon, so check these out. These are kind of cool. Who eats the most at a picnic? Mosquitoes? The dog. My dad, he is chubby. He has a problem. Here's a breakup letter. Sean, I'm breaking up with you. You have not talked to me since the day you asked me out. That was 3 months ago. You need to get it together or you will never get married, and that would be sad. You should get married, just not to me. And then this kid wrote to God, Dear God, I bet it's very hard for you to love everybody in the whole world. There are only 4 people in our family, and I can never do it. So I read that one, and I thought, you know what? God does have a hard job. Loving everyone in the world? I mean, just loving me is a full-time job. But everyone in the world? I am convinced of this truth, and I remind myself of it all the time because, it's phenomenal. The God of the universe is committed to me. How about that thought? Forget anything you've done or what you're committed to or what you think. Just start with that. The God of the universe is committed to us. And the analogy that the Bible uses, which is very cool, is one of marriage. And we are the bride of Christ, the church waiting for the groom to come and usher us down the aisle into glory someday as he takes his bride to heaven to stay forevermore. It's a beautiful analogy. And our groom has been faithful and committed to you and me. I did another wedding last night in New Albany. And I'm up to like 430 now weddings that I've done, which if you do the math, that's 8 years of every weekend. And it's a lot of weddings. And at each wedding, last night, the bride, her father is gone, so her daughter gave her away. But generally, it's the father. And I've got a buddy in Kentucky who preaches in Lexington who did a wedding, and the father gave his daughter away at the wedding, but he gave a little speech before he gave her away. This guy is cool. I wish he came to my church. I want you to listen to what this father said in giving away his daughter in marriage. Check it out.
Philip, I want to tell you a story. And like all good stories, it starts like this. Once upon a time, there was a father. And in case you can't figure that out, that's me. This father had a wonderful little boy. He was very happy. Then one day he found out that his wife was going to have a little baby. So I prayed, Lord, if it's your will, give me a little girl. And he did. I was the first person to hold her in my arms. And I looked at her and I said, Lord, make her like a mother. She was loving, giving, so good and so kind. But then I realized I was getting left out. So I said, Lord, make her like me. And he did. She could drive a truck and a tractor. She could load hay and strip tobacco. You realize what you're getting. But at the same time, she was opinionated, emotional, and hard-headed. So I said, Lord, that's enough of that. Make her like you. And he did. He gave her a desire to serve people. She loves people. She gave her life to being a nurse. She's brought people back from the dead. She's held the hand of people and breathed their last breath. He gave her a heart for missions, and she's trekked all over the world, pushed canoes up swollen rivers, and laid on the floor while bullets whizzed outside so she could tell people about Jesus. But still, something was missing. So I said, Lord, make her happy. See that look on her face? I never saw that until she met you. And I'm grateful for that. Today I'm giving you the best thing I have to give. I just wanted you to know before I do that how hard me and God's worked to get a baby for you. So, Philip, as I give her to you, I don't think you'll mind if I give you one little word of advice. Me and God's worked hard. Don't screw it up.
There's no question how hard God has worked in his relationship with you and with me. The question becomes, how hard have we worked at it? We all know he's committed to us. How committed are we to him? That, I want you to ask yourself that this morning, and there's a way to tell. And that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you a test, all right? How committed are you to God? Well, how committed are you to his children? How committed are you to his church? And how committed are you to his child? That's how committed you are to God. Number one, how committed are we to his children? Doesn't seem to matter how many times I preach about it or how many times you read it in the Bible. People still come away with the dangerous, false conclusion that somehow they can love and have a relationship with God and not love the people around them. Even though we read verses like 1 John 4:20, if someone says, I love God but hates a Christian brother or sister, that person's a liar. For if we don't love people we can see, how can we love God whom we cannot see? Even though we read verses like Matthew chapter 25, verse 40, I tell you the truth, that whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me. And even though we read verses like Mark 12, 31, the second greatest commandment is love your neighbor as yourself. There's no commandment greater than these. And some still conclude, I can have a relationship with God, but still be miserable with all the people around me. Even though we read, for God so loved the world. Well, who's the world? Who did God so love? The Republicans? The Democrats? The white people? Black people? The rich people? The poor people? The Muslim people? How long do I have to go before I get to somebody you don't love? For God so loved the world. You cannot claim to love God and not love and show love to his children. I hope I can pull this off because it makes an interesting point at the end anyway. There was a study recently at Princeton University. These usually go right over my head, but this one caught my attention. It was led by an expert in psychology named Susan Fisk, and she's studying the interpersonal relationships that we have with the people in our world. And she says we put these people in four different categories based on two different measuring sticks. One measuring stick is warmth, and the other is competence. Now, stay with me here. I'll give you an example. Like, if you're in the alley, a dark alley, and you see somebody coming at you, two things are going through your head. The first one is, do they intend me harm, or do they intend me good? That's the first thing. That's the warmth connector. The second one is the competence connector, which means, I wonder if they're able to carry out what it is that they're thinking they're going to do. So she gives us this sociological chart, this social cognition chart. You see the warmth arrow to the left, measuring low to high, and the competence arrow to the bottom, measuring low to high. So I thought, how can I explain this without boring people to tears? So I decided that I would put in each of these groups college basketball teams from the state of Indiana, just to give you a feel for what I'm trying to say before I turn it to Jesus, all right? So let's start with the esteem. Not yet, Terry, all right? Hold off. Terry's jumping the gun on me all day back there. The esteemed in group. Now, this is the group that we most admire and that would be our heroes and that we would put up there with the best of all of them, the people that we esteem. So I would put two college basketball teams in that group. Here we go, Terry. That would be the Indiana Hoosiers and the Butler Bulldogs. That was some roaring applause for that one right there. But I don't care. That's my group. This is my chart. It's my group. Now, secondly, we'll go down to the envied zone. Don't put them up yet, Terry. In the envied zone, these are people you don't necessarily like, but you kind of envy them because they get all the publicity they're the ones with national fans that aren't just from Indiana, and you turn on the TV and there are people in Colorado and California rooting for this team from Indiana. So we'll put in the envy group the Notre Dame Fighting Irish. How about that? That's who I'd put there. So then we go up to the pitied group. These are the lovable losers who try really hard but never make it to the big stage. And in this group, we will put the Indiana State Sycamores, and I'm sorry, Alan and Karen, but the Evansville Purple Aces. All right? Now that leaves one group, doesn't it? That leaves the despised group, the people you have nothing good to say about, the people who throw it in your face every time they have a little measure of success, even though it doesn't match yours. It's probably not who you think it is. Okay, it is. The Purdue Bowling Makers go in that group. Now, let's take away the ball teams, and Jesus comes to earth, the Son of God, the Son of Man, he's the hero. We put Jesus up in the esteemed group, and that's where he belongs, at least from the way we look at it. But Jesus doesn't leave himself in that group. So he takes himself out of the esteemed group, and look where he puts himself. He puts himself in the despised group. You know who we put in the despised group? Homeless people, people of other races, people of other religions, people we don't like. Jesus said once, "Foxes have dens, birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head." Do you know what that means? Now work with me here. You know what that means? Jesus was a homeless man. Jesus was a homeless man. Now let that sink in for a moment. Paul agreed with that in 2 Corinthians 8:9. "For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that through you his poverty might become rich." Now here's the point that I've been wrestling with how to make all week. And I don't know if you'll agree with this or not, but it's my conclusion when studying all this social cognition. You cannot worship a homeless man on Sunday and ignore one on Monday. Right? Right? You cannot worship a homeless man on Sunday and esteem him and put him as your hero and say he's the one, and then ignore one every other time you see him. I'm not looking to make you feel guilty. I claim to be committed to the Lord. And for me, that means I got to learn how to let the needs of other people trump my own schedule, my own wealth, my own agenda. Because I'm committed to the Lord, that means I need to be more committed to Charlie. Because I'm committed to the Lord, that means I need to be more committed to Jim. Because I'm committed to the Lord, that means I need to be more committed to Kurt. Because I'm committed to the Lord, that means I need to be more committed to Greg. Because I'm committed to the Lord, that means I need to be more committed to Dave. Are you committed to the Lord? Well, how committed are you to his children? Secondly, how committed am I to the Lord? Well, how committed am I to his church? That's a good question. We talked a couple of weeks ago about money, and I heard that the United States Treasury is coming out with a new $1 bill to reflect the economic anxiety that we feel. Take a look at it. There it is right there. I got several of those in my wallet. So I'm not going to talk about giving or commitment to giving, but I do want to talk about this for a minute, about the church. Our backgrounds are different. I've probably told you this, so it's not a hard question to answer. Does anybody know? I was born in Dayton, Ohio. I'm a Hoosier, though, because I only lived in the hospital there, and then my mom and dad were visiting when I came along. So they had to go to the hospital right then and there. It wasn't where they planned on having me. So I was born in Dayton, and then when they took me home from the hospital, I didn't go straight home. Guess where I went? Straight to church. Got me out early on a Sunday morning. If anybody had an excuse not to go to church that day, it was me. Right? And they took me straight to church. Parents today won't take their newborn out of the house for 6 months, fearing your germs. They passed me around like a sack of potatoes that day. Every single woman in that church touched me. I'm fine. I didn't get sick. I'm okay. I'm not like the people who say, well, I don't go to church because I was made to go when I was a kid. Don't get me wrong. If I didn't want to, my dad would have made me. I just wanted, I didn't have to be made. I've always been a fan. My first solo was sang in a church. My first wedding I saw was in a church. My first funeral was in a church. My first girlfriend was in a church. First dollar I ever gave was in a church. Even when I was a teenager, I realized I can't make it through life. I screw up too much on my own. I need a group of people around me who are going to love me no matter what I do. I need the church. But not everybody feels that way. There's a 7-year-old in Plain City, Utah, who didn't want to go to church. I mean, he really didn't want to go to church. Check out this headline. Preston Scarborough, 7, steals family car to avoid going to church, leads police on a car chase. Well, you know, when I saw that headline, I had to dive in and find out what was going on. Witnesses say he drove through a stop sign, appeared to be driving recklessly, got up to 40 miles an hour, and the police followed him back to his house in a low-speed chase. He jumps out of the car, runs in the house, and says, "Dad, the police are outside," goes to the basement to hide. The boy's reason for taking the car, his own words, "I didn't want to go to church. It was too hot." Police said they were impressed with the little 7-year-old's driving skills, although one of the officers told the parents, "Please get that boy a more interesting Sunday school teacher." So I moved from that, a 7-year-old driving, stealing his jack and his dad's car to get away from church, to Tyler Allred from Muskogee, Oklahoma, who was guilty of first-degree manslaughter. An Oklahoma District Court judge, Mike Norman, sentenced him to 10 years of church attendance as part of his probation. 10 years of forced church attendance. So we have parents forcing their kids to go to church. We have kids stealing cars to get away from church. We have district court judges using church as punishment. No wonder it's become popular in our culture to diss the church. Well, I'm not participating in that. No use for that. I won't join you in that. I'm a big fan of the church. I always have been. Every good thing in my life is a result of me being a part of the Lord's church. I saw another recent study on the sociological effects of Facebook. And anytime I mention Facebook, I get shot at later. I am not a detractor of Facebook. I'm not. I'm not a proponent either. I understand the value of communication. I do. But sometimes I have to look at what the good is versus the bad and make my own decision. So I'm not judging at all. But I want to tell you a couple of things. How many of you use Facebook? Now, don't worry about putting your hand up. I don't think differently of you. I know most of you do. Hands up. Come on. Some of you are like, "I don't want him to know now." I don't care. I got problems too. Okay, you put them down now. All of you with your hands up, and that's the majority of you, can one person in here tell me the mission statement for Facebook? Or are you just blind followers? Anybody? Somebody trying? Did I hear something? Okay, that's your mission, but the official mission statement of Facebook. Anybody? And again, you can have good use with any kind of communication or tools, that's what they are. It's not a bad mission statement. Matter of fact, I like it. I just wondered if anybody knew. Facebook's official mission statement is to give people the power to share and make the world more open and connected, her with her family. A recent study from the University of Michigan, and this is very recent, like a couple of months ago, produced these results. The more college students used Facebook, the worse they felt about themselves. The stated conclusion, Facebook use led to decline in moment-to-moment happiness and life satisfaction or contentment. It's been clinically diagnosed now. You can suffer from a clinical diagnosis of Facebook despair. Some of you have been afflicted. And I'm no doctor, but I would think that the prescription might be a little less time on that book and a little more time in that book. They also concluded that face-to-face interaction, even just being on the phone, had the opposite effect and led to happier moments and more satisfaction with life. Now, please, again, you don't need to talk to me about this later. I'm not trashing Facebook. I'm not. I'm cool with it. It can be used for ministry. I'm cool. What I'm doing is trying to tell you that we are connected to each other, to Christ's body. We are part of him, not just him, but we're part of the whole body and eternally connected in a way that you're not going to find in any other venue or organization on planet Earth. And if you were ever going to make a firm commitment, a step over the line, I'm all in, up to my neck in it, never going to stop, never going to burn out, never going to quit, signing up for this commitment, it should be to the Lord and his church. Commitment. It's one of those lost words in our society. I'm going to do a sermon series on lost words, words like sacrifice and duty and commitment. One lovesick Romeo wrote a love letter to share his heart with his girlfriend. My dear Susan, I would swim the mighty ocean for one glance from your lovely eyes. I would walk through a wall of fire for one touch of your delicate hand. I would raft on the wildest river, climb the highest mountain for a single word from your warm lips. As ever, your faithful Arnold. P.S. I'll be over to see you Saturday if it doesn't rain. Two really cool things happened in my first ministry. We had a kid that I fell in love with, and I was a kid when I was preaching to these people. His name was Jim James. If your last name is James, why you want to name your boy Jim? Guess what we called him? Jim Jim. Jim Jim. Hey, Jim Jim. That's what everybody called him. He couldn't wait to get away from home and get to church. And when church was over, he was sad because he didn't want to go back home. Terrible home life. Rode his bike to church. A couple miles. Weather got bad, people would pick him up. I loved the kid, absolutely loved the kid. He joined our church basketball team early teen years, was at youth group all the time. About a year and a half into my ministry there, which was only going to last a few more months, he came down the aisle to be baptized. So everybody knew him as Jim Jim. I said, we're going to baptize Jim Jim. We didn't have Baptistry at our little church. What we did, it was called The Creek. It was the coolest baptistry I've ever had. And when I say coolest, I mean that in more than one way. So our whole church walks out together. It's like a scene from Little House on the Prairie. We collectively walk out together singing on our way to the creek. Is that cool or what? It's like, oh, brother, where art thou? When I went down to the, you know what I mean? And there we go. And we go down to the creek, and I'm about to baptize him. And I asked, and I don't know that I've done this before, but I said, you know, I'm just curious. If you've ever taught Jim Jim in a class, raise your hand. If you ever coached him in basketball, raise your hand. If you ever prayed for him or said anything nice to him, raise your hand. I'm just curious. And almost every single hand on that creek bed went up. It was just a visible demonstration of what the church is supposed to be. So I baptized him. And, man, they can't wait to hug him. They're all over him, just loving all over him. You ain't going to get that from Facebook. To be fair, you ain't going to get that anywhere else. That kind of genuine love and joy and purpose and eternal feeling, there's only one place on earth you can get that. That's in the church. It's the Lord's church. So how committed am I to God? Well, how committed am I to his children? How committed am I to his church? Let me close with this. How committed am I to his child? I've wrestled with this building program. I haven't shared my heart completely with you all. I mean, I think we need to do this. The church is a living organism, and living organisms are either growing or they're dying. That's your two choices. They're not ever able to stay the same. So I believe we're growing and we're making root. I'm all for it. But I've been tied down with this campaign, doing things that I don't like to do. I wouldn't call it a waste of time because it's not, but it's not what I want to preach. I just want to preach. I want to preach. And so this has caused me to examine everything we're doing, and I want to say this to you on occasion, and today being that occasion. Everything we do, we need to make sure it's somehow connected to Jesus. Can I have an amen on that? A new building, a new ministry, a song that we sing, an offering that we take, a hug that we give, everything we do here needs to be connected to Jesus. And the commitment we make needs to be through heck and high water, no matter what comes into your life. Because what happens is people listen to televangelists who tell you how wonderful it's supposed to be, and then when it's not, you either question your faith or you walk away from it because you were taught it wasn't supposed to be this way. I hope you're not offended, but I'm telling you, following Jesus can be very disappointing sometimes. Doesn't always work out for me the way I thought it would. But there is no plan B. And when it doesn't go the way I wanted and doesn't go the way that makes me feel good, I need to be just as committed then as I was when he delivered the way I thought he should. I was shopping for clothes years ago in Florence, Kentucky, at the mall, Florence Mall, y'all, if you've ever been there. It's a cool mall. It's about a half an hour from my house. I needed some dress shirts to preach in, and I took my buddy Larry Mingy with me. Larry Mingy was 6'7". From Jackson, Kentucky, he couldn't have weighed more than 120 pounds. I mean, if he stood sideways, if it weren't for his Adam's apple, he wouldn't have any shape at all. You know what I'm saying? And we walk into the mall, and he's like, big bushy mustache and bald, 6'7". Well, I think I'll go down here, Mark. I'm going into this store to find some Kentucky sweatshirts. Okay, Larry, I'm going to go look for dress shirts. We're probably not going to be in the same area. We'll meet at the food court in an hour. So he goes into a store and he says, I'm looking for some UK stuff, some sweatshirts, some socks, some sweatpants. Got any UK stuff? And the guy says, are you from Kentucky? And Larry said, well, yeah, I am. He said, how'd you know? And the guy said, because this is a hardware store. So I go to a store where they actually sold shirts, and I bought some shirts to preach in. I rarely try things on, but I thought, I'm going to try them on and see what they look like. They were different colors, and they were cheap enough for me to buy a few, and I did. And I went into one of those little dressing rooms, which I hate. I'm claustrophobic. I don't like it at all. And I'm looking, and I'm thinking, honestly, hey, that's a good-looking shirt. So I bought it. Bought two or three others. Took them home. Got dressed for Sunday morning. Looked in the mirror. And I swear, it does not look like it looked at the store. I can't believe how bad it looks or how bad I look. It was just 3 or 4 days previous that I looked so good in this shirt. And now, if I knew I was going to look like this, I would have never bought it. So the next week, I went back to the store. I know it's not their fault. I mean, they can only work with what they're working with. But I said, listen, I went home, and this does not look the same on me at home as it does here. And immediately this guy says, it's the lighting, bro. I said, what do you mean? He said, you would not believe how much money our store has spent on studies of the right lighting. It's a science, and we've figured it out. We will always make you look better here than you will ever look when you leave here. And he's right. They did. And I'm afraid churches and preachers have tried to adjust the lighting to make God just look one certain way. And so you have these health and wealth gospel people who are convincing you that if you're a Christian, you won't ever deal with cancer. And if you're a Christian, you won't ever go through financial difficulty. And if you're a Christian, you won't ever struggle with drugs. And if you're a Christian, you won't ever lose your job. And if you're a Christian, you won't ever have anything but a mansion for a home. And if you're a Christian, nothing bad will happen to you. Don't you ever let anyone tell you that just because your life is hard, that somehow means you don't have faith or you're not really one of his. There is no health and wealth gospel. Write it down. There is no health and wealth gospel. There's only the gospel. Whether you're healthy or not, there's only the gospel, whether you're wealthy or not. And being committed to Jesus means that you're going to stick through it even when things don't go the way you wanted them to. I'm committed to the one who can fix things for me. I don't know if you remember when studying history. I'll close with this. Did you study the Habsburg family? Let me show you a picture. They ruled Europe for about 600 years. This is Franz Joseph I. He was the last of the emperors. So this is kind of interesting to me. And he also was the last of the extravagant funerals for their military. Thousands of elegantly dressed court officials, politicians, lined the streets of Vienna as they marched with Franz Joseph I's casket. There were six soldiers carrying the casket as pallbearers and a seventh soldier in the front. Their destination was St. Stephen's Cathedral in Vienna, beautiful building, surrounded by a big gate. The protocol or the format was set years ago, so they know exactly what they're supposed to say and how they're supposed to do it. It's a big production. So the soldiers come to the gate, and the head soldier at the casket, he shouts one word, "Open." And the archbishop on the other side of the gate says, "I'm sorry, who goes there?" And the soldier says, "We bury the remains of Emperor Franz Joseph I, Grand Duke of Lombardy, Prince of Bohemia, Moravia." And on the soldier goes listing 37 different titles of Franz Joseph I. The archbishop on the other side of the gate says, "I'm sorry, in the church we do not recognize a man such as this. Who goes there?" And then the soldier condenses the list to about 12 of the emperor's titles. And again, the archbishop says, "I'm sorry, in the church we do not recognize a man such as this. Who goes there?" And this time, the soldier lists only the humblest of titles. "We bury the remains of Franz, our brother, and sinner like the rest of us." And at that, the gates to the cathedral open wide. Now, I know it's not exactly biblical, but what if the gates to heaven are closed when you get there and the Lord shouts, "Who goes there?" What are you going to say? "Well, I attended that church for 50 years. I tithed on my money. I even gave more than a tithe. I prayed every day. I helped people out. I helped old ladies across the street. I fed hungry people. I've done everything I can do." And you know what he's going to say to that? "We do not recognize such a man in heaven." Matter of fact, he'll be more specific than that. He'll say, "I never knew you." So you better come up with something better than that. And I've got it for you. Try this. "I'm a great sinner. I'm a great sinner who surrendered to a great Savior." And the gates of heaven, at that point, they'll open. How do I know if I'm committed to the Lord? Well, I'll be committed to His children. I'll be committed to His church. I'll be committed to His child. But there's no questioning this truth. The God of the universe is committed to me. Amen.